Now, you've not actually come all the way from Northumbria today. Would that be right, Roy?
That's correct. Yes, I've come from Milnathort.
Hands up if you've ever been to Milnathort. Oh, quite a few. I haven't been to Milnathort. So, tell me about yourself then.
Well, I was born at an early age on Tyneside, and a Geordie by birth and persuasion, and actually came to faith in the Cairngorms of Scotland. I was brought up in an unchurched family, good family, lots of great things, good parents, all the rest, but came to faith training to be an Outward Bound instructor at the Outward Bound School on the Moray Firth. And so life took a different direction.
Yeah.
I went off to Bible College, university. While I was at university in Cardiff, I met, well, actually, I was... Your father, Helen, was a great and godly mentor to me in my time at Cardiff. I'm married, I have four children. I'm not Catholic, just irresponsibly Protestant. And have five grandchildren, which is God's reward for surviving the kids. I live in the Cheviot Hills of Northumberland, just over the Scottish border. I curl in Scotland and play tennis in England. And that's me.
Yeah.
I'm a Baptist pastor. But I haven't been in local Baptist ministry for, oh gosh, since 1991.
Wow. Okay. And I was a bit hesitant about calling you the leader of the Northumbria community. Would my hesitancy be wise, or are you the leader of the Northumbria community?
I'm one of the leaders of the Northumbria.
One of the leaders.
I'm one of the founders of the Northumbria community, and you know, I've reached that stage in life where I'm the one remaining founder who is still on the leadership. So it's a bit like being a granddad. You know, it's not good for your ego, but it's quite pleasant an experience to see the next generations coming on. So I'm one of the leaders, and my role has changed over the years.
Okay, well, why don't you grab a seat? And I'm intrigued by this idea of you becoming a Christian or committing your life to following Jesus in the Cairngorms when you're an instructor. But I've got a feeling that's quite another story, mm-hmm. and it'd be interesting to hear it some other time. Maybe over coffee afterwards. Let's have a look at today's reading. It's in the book of Jeremiah, and it's Jeremiah chapter 6. Now, when I read this before, I missed out the very final line of verse 16. Is that okay?
Yep. Yeah.
So it's on page number 763, if you want to follow in the Pew Bibles, that is. We're reading from verse 10 to the end of, well, almost to the end of verse 16. I'm missing out the very last line. So this is God speaking through the prophet Jeremiah. Begin verse 10. To whom can I speak and give warning? Who will listen to me? Their ears are closed so they cannot hear. The word of the Lord is offensive to them. They find no pleasure in it. But I am full of the wrath of the Lord, and I cannot hold it in. Pour it out on the children in the street and on the young men gathered together. Both husband and wife will be caught in it. And the old, those weighed down with years, their houses will be turned over to others, together with their fields and their wives, when I stretch out my hand against those who live in the land, declares the Lord. From the least to the greatest, all are greedy for gain. Prophets and priests alike all practice deceit. They dress the wound of my people as though it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. Are they ashamed of their loathsome conduct? No, they have no shame at all. They do not even know how to blush. So they will fall among the fallen. They will be brought down when I punish them, says the Lord. This is what the Lord says. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it. And you will find rest for your souls.
Well, in the words of St. Cuthbert, as he greeted King Edwin on the mound, hi, it's good to be here. It's a joy and a privilege, and I look forward to being with you next Saturday as I lead you on a retreat as we explore some of the treasures of the Celtic tradition. My wife and I, in the last couple of weeks, we've been to a couple of strange parties and an interesting concert. 2 weeks ago, we were at an 80s party. And we hadn't got a clue what was going on, because the 80s just kind of passed us by. It was the era of Spandau Ballet and all that kind of stuff. We were just having our small children there and learning to survive. But last night we went to a Beatles tribute band concert at Glenrothes. And that was definitely our era. And there we were with lots of other people, predominantly pensioners, folks in their 60s and 70s, the odd young person in their 40s. And just listening to the Beatles music, it was great music, and it kind of signified a major revolution that was going on in Britain at that time. Really significant period, certainly for music anyway. The history of the world has known other significant periods. As you celebrate your anniversary 200 years ago, Britain was at war with America. 200 years ago this year, the Battle of Waterloo, when we defeated the French. And significant times. The Corn Law came about in 1815, which was to protect British farmers from foreign imports. There's a lot of things that haven't changed. We're living in an extraordinary period, not just in the life of the nation here in Scotland, but in the world. The times, in the words of Bob Dylan, another 60s artist, they are a-changing. And when it comes to faith and the Christian church, we're living in very, very changing times. If you think of the imagery of a tide coming in and out, the tide of Christendom is going out. And Christianity, that has been a major influence upon Western culture and society, European civilization, is just one now of many voices. And it is not the strength of voice that it once was. And perhaps we need to learn what Jeremiah was encouraging his contemporaries to realize. What it was to sing the Lord's song in a strange land. What it is to live out faith in a predominantly secular and consumer and different world. And so he says, this is what the Lord says, Jeremiah 6:16. Stand at the crossroads and ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is. Walk in it and you'll find rest for your souls. I believe we're at a crossroads. Crossroads, a critical moment in our churches. I bring the greetings of the Baptist Union of Great Britain because I'm involved at that national leadership level, and I'll be in Swanwick, Derbyshire tomorrow. And part of the meeting tomorrow is to recognize that we're at a crossroads. In our churches and our denominations, I suggest we're at a crossroads in terms of the United Kingdom, despite the referendum. We're at a crossroads in relation to Europe and certainly all that's going on in the world today. The challenges and pressures are many, and the opportunities are few. So why do we bother looking at the past when the issues are pressing in the present and our eyes should be to the future? Bono of U2. When people are looking for the future, they'll often try and reinvent or rediscover the past. We know from the realms of psychology and psychotherapy that one of the recurring themes that face people in the human psyche is that of belonging and a sense of identity. Where is my home? And for a lot of people, as they look for that, they look to the past. Michael Flatley was interviewed on Front Row the other night. He is eventually retiring because his body is just absolutely done in. But can you remember the Eurovision Song Contest when Riverdance kind of hit the stage? It was a phenomena. And it triggered off all kinds of people, a kind of resurgence in that which was Celtic. And as we think about our identity as Northumbrians or as Scots, and you know they were kind of intermingled, because Northumbria was from the Forth to the Humber. When I'm in Yorkshire, I talk about it from the Humber to the Forth, but I'm being politically correct and contextual here. Our nation, our culture, was shaped by our history. And there are lots of things that have shaped the Scottish nation, but I want to explore with you a little now, but more particularly next Saturday when I'm with you, how Christianity was brought to Britain by the Celtic saints, and how this nation was predominantly shaped by Celtic forefathers and mothers. A phenomenal movement that God raised up in the 5th to the kind of 8th, 9th century here in Britain that not only shaped and brought Christianity to bear upon this nation, but from this nation traveled throughout the rest of Western Europe and back into Eastern Europe from which it had come. We actually get Christianity from the Celts. The Celts were a tribe. They were called the Celtoi. That's where you get your name Kilt from. They were a northern tribe in Turkey. And they traded and they traveled across and they brought with them the stories of the Christian saints of the desert fathers and mothers. And they journeyed to places, and particularly it took root in Ireland. And Patrick returns to Ireland. You'll know the story. It's Patrick's day on Tuesday this week. And from Ireland to Iona, and from Iona to Lindisfarne, cradle of Christianity. Lindisfarne, a major base of mission that then journeyed with the light of Christ across Europe. When people tend to talk about revivals and those great periods in church history in our nation, people tend to often think about things like the Hebridean revivals. But I think, helpful and inspirational though some of those things are, if we want to look at a spirituality and a period in history that didn't just last for a few years, but shaped European culture for centuries, we need to go back to the Celts. And the other reason why we need to go back to the Celts is all the other revivals that have come during a period in history that was under what was called Christendom, when the church was the dominant thing that it was, when the life of the nation was shaped by Christianity. But the context has changed for us today. The big dominant philosophies and outlooks of world today in Western culture are consumerism. I drove through Edinburgh this morning, over the Forth Road Bridge and then through the city. There will be more people shopping in Edinburgh today than will be worshipping God. Ally consumerism with secularism, and Christianity is a bit part philosophy and religion. Less so here in Scotland as in England, but don't think that what has happened in England will not happen to Scotland. Congregations are declining. Congregations are aging. Peter Nielsen of the Church of Scotland at your General Assembly in 2001 said if we continue at the present rate of decline, there will not be a single kirk by the year 2038. It was a wake-up call. It was a prophetic word. And some things have resulted, but the reality is of decline. Il Milnathort, where I was, where my good friends went to live there a number of years ago now, there was a fabulous church. That church now has 10 apartments. There's no worship. There's no service. The church has gone. Our world is a bit more like the world of the fall of the Roman Empire, in which the Celtic saints emerged. It wasn't a Christian worldview in which the Christian faith emerged. It was the fall of the Roman Empire, and nobody could have predicted or imagined the fall of the Roman Empire. Rome was mighty, militarily, politically, economically, culturally, organizationally, whatever way you want to think about it, nobody could have envisaged that this major superpower would have fallen. Will Hutton, a leading economist, says, we need to actually be preparing for the fact when America one day will no longer be an economic superpower. The rise of China, the rise of India, the rise of Islam, the threat of terrorism, the world is changing. Russia feeling alienated, therefore like a frightened dog, beginning to flex its muscles again in Ukraine. I have a Ukrainian daughter-in-law. I have a family, relatives of her, who actually live in eastern Ukraine, just 2 hours from Donetsk. My younger son was the academic dean in Donetsk. It is no more the university he taught at, blitzed and bulldozed by Russian militia. These are things that are impacting and affecting the world. These are things that could seriously impact Western culture. So it's in that context, parallel to the context of Jeremiah's day, when his frustration was with the contemporary religious leaders of his day who were saying, it's there in Jeremiah 6, you are saying peace, peace, but there is no peace. My favorite definition of leadership is by a writer called Max Dupré, who says the first task of leadership is to define reality. We must be really careful in the church that we don't embrace the spirituality of la-la land, of King Canute, of pretending that things aren't happening, that are quite disturbing. When it feels more like exile than advancement. When you look back on the 200 years history of the church here, there'll be times when this place was absolutely bunged with people and the gallery was full. And what you saw this morning as people were queuing for the second service, about a dozen people, keen and enthusiastic or just desperate to get out their own homes, as they kind of were queuing. In times past, these services, all of them, would have been full. That is not the reality for us today, even though it's great, it's signs of encouragement in your congregation. The church is declining. Post-Christendom is here. Jeremiah's message is stark. Examine, look, be real. Look at what's happening outside in the world. I think one of the biggest threats to stability and to peace within the Western world is the reemergence of tribalism. One of the things that the Celtic saints brought was the ability to celebrate kinship, to celebrate where we come from, to celebrate the family groups and tribes that we're a part of, without turning tribalism into sectarianism, which has been the curse of the church and the blight on society through the history of the world. We're seeing the emergence of tribalism again all the way across Europe. Attach that to blame culture, and then you start to create enemies who were once friends and who were former neighbors. I mention I'm English, and some people just go, they groan. So then I say, I'm actually a Johnson, and my mother was from Scotland. And then that suddenly makes me acceptable. On my father's side, he's a Searle, obviously. They're from Brittany. It is possible for the Searles, the Bretons, and the Scots to get on together, okay? We must end sectarianism. We must put an end to the tribalism. And it can begin in the Church of God. The wars and the rumors of wars. Economists tell us that after every global recession, there will be a major war. You just have to look out for where it is. And that's what's happening in the world today. Middle East, Eastern Europe. Look what's happening. Lent is a period that we're in now as we lead to that great celebration of Easter. Lent is a period of thinking about things and reflecting on things. And it's not to be pessimistic. I'm actually more buoyant than the prophet Jeremiah, who I'm sure was a depressive, but he faced us with some stark realities, and we need to be faced with some stark realities. How do we respond? Jeremiah says, look for the ancient paths. And when God calls his people to exile, puts them in exile, there are, yes, elements of judgment that come upon us. We reap what we sow. I was saying in the first service that on a previous occasion when I was in Edinburgh and I met somebody who was on that march, came up to speak to me after the coffee break. Can you remember the G8 summit? And can you remember the march in Edinburgh to make poverty history? Remember? I walked alongside Alex Salmond down Princess Street. He challenged me and said, where's the voice of nonconformity in Parliament today? I've still not been able to answer him. Now, I realize that, as I said in the first service, I've asked to become a friend or a foe to many of you by mentioning his name. But as we walked that walk and we urged the G8 leaders to drop the debt, to bring trade justice, to alleviate suffering and poverty, and the Millennium Development Goals, which are great aspirational things, the G8 nations failed miserably and, I believe, committed an atrocious sin and evil in the sight of God. And for me, I make a connection between the failure of the Western nations to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless, and the judgment that has come upon us. We have spent £28 billion in the United Kingdom on armaments in Iraq and Afghanistan. Think about what that could have done to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to welcome the stranger. Jeremiah would say to us, I believe, can you not see the connection between terrorism that threatens the very world order and poverty and injustice and exploitation? Where the rich West get richer, the poor not only get poorer, they get angry, they get violent. And the threat now is not to blitz and bomb everybody, because two teenagers can put a few chemicals together and hold the Western world to ransom. Christianity has a lot to say about the contemporary pressures and challenges of our world. Sow the seeds of war, you reap a whirlwind of war. The Bible tells us that. Or think about the issues of poverty that we face within the world. How do we respond? I believe when God calls his people and creates judgment, it's not simply to punish, but to remind us of the things that we need to rediscover. Help us to rediscover again what it means to live for God and to express his ways. God allowed his people to go into exile because they'd forgotten things. They'd forgotten things like their first love. Where I live in North Northumberland, just south of the Scottish borders, I am seriously about one of the youngest people in any of the churches in my area of North Northumberland. I could be the youth fellowship. And you know, one of the major contributing factors to the closure of churches, when I trained for the ministry in 1976 to 79 at a college in Berwick before going off to university, there were 17 Methodist churches in the circuit. There's now two. There were 11 full-time stipendiary clergy folk in Glendale, North Northumberland, and now there's 2.5. The churches have closed. The Methodist church that I cut my teeth on preaching closed years ago. I don't think there's a connection between me cutting my teeth and the church closing. But you know, one of the factors is we lost our first love. We loved our buildings more than we loved God. We loved our way of doing things more than we loved God. We loved the pews more than we loved God. We loved the color of the carpet more than we loved God. We loved our minister, or at least the last minister, more than we loved God. And so God gives us what we sowed, so shall we reap. So if you come to North Northumberland, there's some wonderful church buildings, but there's no church there. They're monuments and museum pieces. Let's heed the challenge of Jeremiah, who says, peace, peace, when there was no peace. I have a friend who's a businessman, and he's kind of on the cusp of Christianity, but there are bits about Christianity that he just doesn't get. And I try to reassure him, there's loads of bits of Christianity that I don't get, but I still follow Jesus and seek to love God. And he says, I just don't understand you Christians. He said, why do you spend all those synods and councils and meetings and conferences discussing, this is his thing, discussing whether women can be in leadership? Why do you spend all those hours debating the color, seriously, of your carpets and whether you're going to have cups or mugs to serve coffee? He says there's a starving world outside. There's people suffering. I just don't get it. And why can't you get on with one another? So I come to the defense of the church, and then I realize, actually, it's pretty indefensible. Our inability to get on with one another is a flagrant denial of the command of Jesus that we should be, and his prayer, that we should be one as he and the Father are one. Jesus, on that last night in which he was with his disciples before he was taken, has them in the upper room, and he's praying, and he's talking with them, and he's breaking bread. It's a very special communion that day. And he says to them that I pray that you may be one as I and the Father am one. And then he goes on to say, the world will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. But we've allowed ourselves to fall out with one another, to split. I was in one of your cities the other day, doing a day for the NHS, some of their managers, and with my friend who was taking me there, and kind of pointing out there's a Baptist church. I know there's a Baptist church there because I preached there many, many moons ago. And then we pass another Baptist church, and I say, there's another Baptist church in the same street, about 500 yards away. I said, was that because of church planting and church growth? He said, no, they fell out. Lord, have mercy upon us. Lord, have mercy upon us. May we have that which was imbibed by Wesley, the great Methodist. If your heart is with my heart in love and loyalty to Jesus Christ, come, let us walk the road together. In our Northumbria community, that's why we have Catholics and Protestants. We have half of the people who don't know what they are. All over the world, got Orthodox people and house church people and particularly younger generations of people who are just connecting. And the barriers that once existed are coming down. Jeremiah says, stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. In closing, what would these ancient paths look like? This is what I want to share with you next Saturday on the retreat. What are the Celtic treasures from the past that will help us today to live for Jesus and to be restored and renewed in the things that we need to be restored and renewed in, or we need to help discover in order for us to live in this different exilic context? Quickly, as a kind of taster. Celtic spirituality, Christian spirituality is monastic. If you want to understand what the Celts were doing, they were bringing a monasticism. Different from medieval monasticism, different from cloistered monasticism. In the monasteries of the Celtic period, there were married people and single people, and there were kind of full-time brothers and sisters, you know, monks and nuns, but there were people who weren't. In the monastic enclosure, it wasn't like a cloister. There was always the open gate. People were coming and going all the time. But there was always an oratory or a cell, and it was a reminder to everybody that the first call upon our lives is to seek God, the great commandment, to love the Lord your God with heart, soul, mind, and strength. I asked them the first thing, how many people are from Glasgow? Are there any folks from Glasgow? That's great. That's lovely. I can come and have my tea with you. Anyway, the city of Glasgow was founded by a Celtic monk called Kentigern Mungo. And he rang a handbell on the banks of the River Clyde. And that was a very, very powerful symbol. When people heard the handbell, they knew it was an invitation and a summons to come and to worship God. What a fantastic foundation for a city. A monk who gathered people, founded the city by praising God and proclaiming his word. It's a great foundation. Second thing of the Celts was they were community. They lived community. They couldn't have understood the individualism of our Western culture that actually is has led us up a cul-de-sac and certainly led us to a place where we find it really difficult to live with people who are different from us. The theologian Jürgen Moltmann talked about we need to rediscover the doctrine of the Trinity, because the loss of the doctrine of the Trinity has led to an excessive individualism within the West. We even got it in the church. It's me and Jesus. It's just me and my personal walk with God. God is Trinity. God is community. If we're made in the image of God, we're meant to be in community. We're meant to relate to other people. And the Celts brought that. They had no sacred or secular divide. There wasn't like religious things that you did and then like ordinary everyday things. It was the whole of life was holy to God. They embraced creativity. So you see the musicians, the singers here today, because it's very Celtic, all right? Because, you know, the Celts were seriously into music. They were into dance. The Irish word Enkali, from which we get the word Cayley, comes all the way back from that kind of 4th and 5th century. Celts used to gather often at riversides, meeting places, barns. They would stick a cross up. They would sing, they would dance, they would eat, they would drink, they would share their stories. They were a festive people, celebratory people, creative people, jewelry, arts, calligraphy. They had an appreciation of nature. They weren't pantheists, they didn't worship nature, but they had an appreciation of nature, that there's a way in which we need to live in accord and rhythm and appreciation of what God has created. They wouldn't have been into Tesco's 24/7. It's not the way in which the world is created. We're meant to rest. We're meant to have strawberries in the summer, not on Boxing Day. It's a madness. It's a madness. We haven't kind of cottoned on to the root of the word consumer means to consume, means to devour, means to kill. What's consumerism does? It's killing our relationship with ourselves, God, and the environment. Celts would be appalled. The Bible was at the heart of their life. Scripture was the source of learning that informed the whole of life. They cared for the poor. Stories which I'll share next week Bridget with her hospitality in Ireland. Oswald, King Oswald, was known for his generosity. Wouldn't it be fantastic if our political leaders were known for their generosity? Wouldn't it? Well, me and two other people here think it'd be a really good idea if our leaders were known for their generosity. Aidan blessed Oswald because when the poor came knocking at the gate, they didn't have to go through a kind of like means test to discover whether they were able to be on benefits. Oswald, with the food on the tables, said not only just take the food out to them, he says take the plates, because food will feed them for a day, but the plates will give them a means to actually get back and to work and to provide for their families. And Oswald, seeing Aidan's action, lifted his arm and blessed him for his generosity. Wouldn't it be wonderful if our political leaders were known for their generosity? Oswald gave of his riches to dispose for the well-being of his citizens. The disparity between wealth and poverty in Britain today is absolutely stark and growing. Thank God for food banks. But like Martin Luther, if you haven't seen the film Selma, let me encourage you to go and see it. Martin Luther says, as Christians, we're really good at being the good Samaritan, at tending and nursing and providing and getting shelter. What we're not so good about is going up the Jericho Road and saying, why was he beaten up in the first place? The Celts remind us of God's heart for the poor, of the statement of Jesus that it is whatsoever you do to the least of these, my children, you do to me. Turn the stranger aside and cast them out and say, we can't afford you. You do to me, says Jesus. When you see a hungry person and you say, well, they just need to shake up a bit, you do it unto me, says Jesus. The Celts remind us of the place of the poor. And then there was also the place of women. Many women are poor because we don't give them a place. The Celts would look horrified at the way in which some churches and certainly our organization has not valued women and regarded women with an equality and a respect. Women shaped Celtic culture. Thank God for those women whom God is raising up in our day and generation to lead us and to kind of remove the male testosterone, male leadership that has got us into all kinds of issues of conflict and violence. It's Mother's Day. We need more mothers in leadership who can nurture, who can care, who can help deal with the conflict and violence that's deep in the human psyche. Final couple of things. We'll explore all these next week. The signs and wonders. Bede, the historian, who was a Roman historian, who kind of was a bit ambivalent towards the Celts because he couldn't understand them because they were a bit... He described them as chaotic, and on another occasion, he records them as vagrants, which I don't think was a complimentary term. But he does say of them that they lived what they taught. And when he's writing about their lives and their ministries and their work and their communities, he records the signs and wonders and the miracles that accompanied their lifestyle. Down-to-earth lifestyle, didn't get big religious, didn't run conferences and run DVDs on how to do miraculous things. Just incorporate it into the midst of life. Signs and wonders. And finally, the Celts were wanderers and risk takers. There's a guy who I met over coffee who worked for the European Parliament in Luxembourg for many years. You know who I'm talking about. Celtic saints went to places like Luxembourg. They were wanderers. They didn't go off on a 10-day mission. They actually went and they never came back. They wandered for the love of Christ. And, you know, if we're to be the people of God reaching out to the peoples of the world, we have to be able to be prepared to wander beyond the walls of the church. We have to be prepared to be adventurers for Christ and take some risks. I was at an association of a different denomination and they were discussing their mission strategy. And it was really kind of authentic and dynamic and quite inspiring. And then it was opened up for questions. And the first question was, has there been a risk analysis? kind of missed the point, really, but suckered by the culture. We operate out of a fear of legislation culture now. We're afraid to take risks. Let's be a bit nonconformist. You can do that as folks in the Church of Scotland. You have a bit of a history of standing up against state and other organizations. And as Baptists, I spent half my life as a former president trying to get Baptists to rediscover their origins. Nonconformists. We might as well be called bland Baptists now, for the sake of Christ. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient path. Ask where the good way is. And this is the great promise of Jeremiah. You'll find rest for your souls. You'll find a good way to live. The good news of the gospel is good news, because it's actually about a good way to live. A way to live that brings to bear the life of Christ. I have to confess that despite having a daughter in school many years ago and a number of friends in Edinburgh, I wasn't quite sure where the kirk was here in Liberton. I know that's akin to the unforgivable sin, but I kind of knew vaguely. But I had no fears, no qualms this morning as I got into my car and I just tapped into sat-nav. And it got me all the way, it has a preference for hospitality, so it got me all the way to the cafe over the road. But it was a good way. God's way is a good way. May he, through the inspiration of the Celtic saints, guide us in his ways. Not only in this anniversary year, but as you journey on from here into the future with his grace. Amen.
I think it'd be good if we just spend a few moments in silence now, just asking that question, what are the things that God has been saying to us today, and what are we going to do about them?